I was born and raised in the state spelled M-I-S-S-O-U-R-I. The way I say it is Missouri. But hey, I'm no senator.
I'm Kit Bond. I'm from Missouri.
That's what the former U.S. senator, a Republican, told Christopher Husted of KBIA, who paid him a visit to discuss the pronunciation of the state he once represented as an elected official. As you heard, he says Missouri.
That's the way I was brought up, and the people around me called it Missouri, and it always seemed more comfortable to me to call it Missouri.
He's awfully convincing. Like, I'm practically ready to change my mind and start saying it that way myself, except here's Democrat Claire McCaskill looking back on her political career in an interview with C-SPAN from December of 2018.
I just kind of made up my mind when I was a fairly young teenager that I needed to be the first woman governor of Missouri.
Let's hear that again.
Governor of Missouri.
Maybe this seems like a partisan divide, but I don't think so. Here's George H.W. Bush back in 1988 campaigning in, well, let's hear him say where he was campaigning.
I'm delighted to be back in Missouri.
1988 was what, a third of a century ago? But since then, confusion's only grown. Listen to Barack Obama trying to say it both ways. At least that's what it sounds like to me.
I also just spoke with Governor Jay Nixon of Missouri.
Excuse me?
Of Missouri.
Nice. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And we're talking Missouri versus Missouri in 2020 because it does seem to be, at least in part, a political question. My first guest is Christopher Husted. He joins us from KBIA in Columbia. He was the senior producer of a podcast called Show Me the State, and he did a whole episode on this topic. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. How do you say the name of the state?
I say Missouri because that's how I was taught to say it.
We heard a little bit of the conversation you had with Kit Bond just a moment ago. Why did you go to Kit Bond's house, of all places, to talk about these two ways of pronouncing Missouri? Why him?
That was sort of the impetus for the episode on the pronunciation of the state name. We talked to a lot of people about it. We've had this conversation as a state, you know, over Thanksgiving, at the bar, at the coffee shop. Everyone has an opinion of how you should say this. And a lot of people point to this legend of Kit Bond doing a poll when he was running for governor in the 70s, deciding which way he should pronounce it as a political strategy. So why not go right to the source for the beginning of our episode to figure out, hey, why did you do this and what did you find out?
So we, you know, big picture, what are the geographic, maybe geographic, economic, or social distinctions within the state that these pronunciation differences kind of represent?
Right now it's interesting because it's taken on this whole political angle, but typically people point to rural versus urban. Sometimes they point to northern versus southern. They'll point to your education level or your socioeconomic status. And everyone has a different reason why they pronounce it a different way. But a lot of those demographics are sort of what people initially will say. Well, you say it that way because you're from this area, or you say it that way because you went to school here. Sort of those reasons.
What did you learn from your podcast that you didn't know already? Just a couple of little fun facts to tease right now.
Right. I learned one thing was kind of fun, that Missouri versus Missouri isn't the only pronunciation debate that we've had. Back in the 1890s, there was a debate over should we pronounce Missouri, the two S's in there, as Missouri, so it's a sibilant S, like snake. And a bunch of teachers from the East Coast who were in Missouri tried to get that pronunciation established as the proper pronunciation, but there was a big debate. Then it took place a lot in the newspapers and editorials about should we pronounce it Missouri or Missouri. Obviously, Missouri sort of won in the public opinion there. That's one big thing. The other thing I think is, you know, we tried to pinpoint exactly when the divide started between Missouri versus Missouri. And we couldn't exactly find the exact moment, but the French explorers in the 1700s sort of interpreted the name of what the Native Americans or the indigenous people in Illinois called the area now known as Missouri, but they tried to translate that word into English. So you have the French taking a Native American word and trying to translate it into English. So from the get-go, there was a lot of different spellings and pronunciations. So it might have been around there that we think that that word became sort of this cultural moment of pronunciation.
Call 816-235-2888 to share your theory about who says Missouri, who says Missouri, and if you're so inclined, who's right. 816-235-2888. So there's how we say it here if we live here. That's one issue. But nationally, there's some political expediency that factors into how people say it. And Chris, I wonder if you can talk to me a little bit about that.
Right. Well, you know, for the episode, we talked to some political strategists. And politicians, when they are trying to connect with voters, they are very careful of the words they choose. They want to make sure that they are connecting with the voters using the proper words. So oftentimes they do message testing, they'll do polls about what messages are resonating with their voters. Are they understanding are the voters understanding what the politicians are trying to say? And oftentimes that will be how they pronounce words. For us, we found lots of recordings of different candidates or politicians that are already in office pronouncing Missouri and Missouri in different speeches, depending on where they were at and which group they were talking to. So it takes on this connection angle where the politician is trying to find themselves or make themselves relatable to whomever they're speaking to.
It's basically code switching.
Exactly. And code switching is changing shifting the language that you use to the way you express yourself in conversation. So that means, you know, your word choice, the order of your words, the way you pronounce it, the style you're speaking in to a different one for whatever reason. Sometimes we do it voluntarily and sometimes we do it unintentionally.
Claire McCaskill is an example of someone who usually says Missouri, as we've heard, but she has come under fire for occasionally tossing in a Missouri here and there. She's not the only one who does that, as you've mentioned. It's really interesting, too, in like campaign advertising or in the commercials, you know, that who is narrating has a little bit more leeway there. And that's a clever kind of use of the narrator to get it in there both ways.
Absolutely. And you can find some ads where they have the state name pronounced differently within the same ad.
What's the overall purpose of that? I get that they're trying to appeal to different people. Do you think that people in Missouri or Missouri care so much how someone pronounces that word that it would affect their vote?
It's such a good question, and I wish we could do a poll on this to really know the answer about it. But I think that Missouri voters at this day and age are very aware of the code switching of the pronunciation. You know, maybe a couple decades ago, it wasn't so evident, but people are smart enough to read between the lines and understand that when they're being pandered to or when they are actually connecting with a politician. And I should mention, we see this in Republicans and Democrats, so it's not party specific. But I do think the voters have caught on to it. Whether the politicians are strategically using both pronunciations or one of them, or just going with what they know or how they grew up, kind of like Kit Bond did.
I don't know if we're really deep enough into the 2020 election cycle to say what we're going to hear on this year. Are you already hearing anything? Because your ears have been attuned to it.
Right. You know, I would say, especially with 2020 coming up, the way Missouri has been used in the past had, you know, connotations of, you know, where you're from. It's taken on a political agenda a bit more, as people who say Missouri tend to equate themselves more with conservative values. So you will hear more people in rural communities that voted, say, for President Trump back in 2016 using the Missouri pronunciation. And that's sort of how, you know, the conservative values have fallen in line with rural values. As far as what's happening now, people are using it much more to differentiate themselves politically because of that pronunciation. I think we might see it more. I haven't seen it jump up just yet, but you know, it's we're just in the caucus era, so we'll see how it goes once the general election begins.
We will get back to politics, but before we get too far into this whole conversation, I do want to bring in a linguist, Matt Gordon. He teaches English and linguistics at Mizzou, and he's going to help us understand the language piece of it, why our state gets pronounced two different ways in the first place. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
What are the origins of this weird phenomenon to the best of your knowledge?
Well, it's pretty shrouded in mystery. As Christopher alluded to, part of it starts with the original term, which was a term from the Illinois language, an Algonquin language, for a people who were completely different people, the Asuan people, the Oto Missouri people. That original word written by French speakers came down through the ages. When linguists started looking at this sort of thing at the early part of the 20th century, they did surveys up and down the East Coast and in other parts of the country. And I think it's important to recognize that the we're focused on the word Missouri, and that's probably the most significant salient one for us today. But it's actually part of a small group of words. So it wasn't just Missouri, Missouri, but you had things like Cincinnati, Cincinnata. Or,
Cincinnata.
Yeah.
I like it.
One that is still relevant today is Miami. So we have Miami, Florida, but in Oklahoma, it's Miami. And there's lots of Miamas around the country there. So you have that's important because it really gets us away from that particular word and shows us that it was a small set of words that all had this same pattern of variation in the way the final vowel was pronounced.
It's interesting to me when I think about French pronunciation, the letter I does not sound like a. Is it that there was a... I'm kind of confused about that.
Yeah, and it... Just to go a little bit deeper on that, yeah, so the word, I'm not really too convinced of any French influence at all, even though it was French explorers who first recorded the word. Once it enters English, it sort of enters into this pattern. So today we think of it as an E sound versus an A sound, but actually the researchers who were looking at this, say, 70, 80 years ago, they found that the sound was actually more commonly like a short I sound. So instead of Missouri E, it would be more like Missouri I, or okay. Even Missouri U. So it's sort of, if you think
what
about
you
that,
call,
that's about...
If you're into linguists, you call that the schwa sound, just the U.
Well, it's a little bit, it's sort of halfway between the sound that we think of today, which I think would regularly be called the schwa, and the E sound there. So it's sort of phonetically, it's halfway in between there. And so
it's like what Barack Obama was doing.
Yeah, very much so, yes.
Okay, are the tendencies, either way, Missouri, Missouri, still evolving as far as you can tell? I know you've done some research on what people say now.
Yes, it's an interesting question because I've done a lot of research on different speech patterns in the state of Missouri or Missouri, and there's lots of things that people will not be aware of. That's the kind of thing that linguists generally like to study. So differences, for example, one that's very widespread across the state is another one related to vowels, whether you pronounce the name Don, D-O-N, and the name Dawn, or the Dawn of a New Day, D-A-W-N, whether you say those the same. So do you say Don and Dawn, or do you say Don and Dawn? That's a difference that is very widespread across the state. Even in a place like Kansas City, people maybe older than 50 or so may have a difference, but people younger than that traditionally don't have a difference these days. So that's a change that nobody is aware of. You never hear people saying, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe that person said Don and Don the same." It just has no
like Don, so, D-O-N, the name, and D-A-W-N.
Exactly.
Sky thing.
Yeah, the dawn of a new day. Yeah. So, but that's an example of a pronunciation difference that is completely under the radar. People don't comment on it or all. Missouri, Missouri is very different. As you know, people are very conscious of it. It's you're sort of marking your affiliation with some social identity as soon as you're forced to say the word.
And that phenomenon is why it's so persistent, because we sort of like dig our heels in on it.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a choice that you have to make. There's really no way of avoiding it. So if you say Missouri, then you're sort of declaring yourself as a Missouri person. If you say Missouri, you're declaring yourself as a Missouri person. And what I find interesting is investigating what that means. What do people mean by affiliating with a particular kind of social identity.
What do they mean? Because you have actual info. You have done a survey on the MU campus there in Columbia, right?
Right. We've done some surveys trying to ask people from different parts of the state which form they use. And one thing that we find is very few people admit in this sort of conscious survey, you know, you put a piece of paper in front of them, they think of it as a test of correctness. And so they will more often say, oh, I say Missouri. Now, they may really say Missouri, or they may say Missouri, but they just don't want to admit it in the context of, you know, some student asking them which one they say.
Yeah, like it's how you say you're going to vote versus how you actually vote.
Yes, that's a great analogy. But what we also ask is, do people from your hometown say Missouri or Missouri? There we find that over half of the respondents said that they come from a place where other people in their town say Missouri. So I don't say it, but certainly people in my town say it. So that suggests to me that it is very widespread across the state, but it's also very variable. So you won't find anywhere in the state where 100% of the people say Missouri or Missouri. Well, I say that's, you might find like 98% of the people say Missouri in St. Louis. That's a different issue.
Do you think St. Louis is a special situation?
Yes, in many ways, St. Louis, when it comes to language, the St. Louis dialect situation is a very special case for the state of Missouri.
Let's talk to Dale. We're going to get to our callers now and hear what they say. Dale is calling us from Kansas City. Hi, Dale.
Good morning.
What do you want to share?
I grew up in Northeast Missouri, and it was my family used that pronunciation, and I've never even noticed a difference until I had moved over and was teaching in the Kansas City area, and I used to. Occasionally, and my kids and I would get in a discussion, which was correct, Missouri or misery. And I would jokingly tell them the enunciation of the one was misery and the other one Missouri, so you know which one is obvious. And most of them took it with good humor. And, I mean, I think it's more of a regional thing. I don't know if education of has any impact on anything that I learned in that regard.
Well, Dale, thank you so much for that call. And we haven't talked about that it does. Missouri, if you put a different syllabic emphasis, is misery, which is too bad for us.
Can I just say, Dale's experience is actually really informative because he said he was from northeastern Missouri, and although it's a kind of stereotype that Missouri is the southern form, in fact, it's much more common traditionally in northern Missouri, and particularly northwestern Missouri. So from Kansas City up to St. Joe and further north, that's solid Missouri territory traditionally.
Missouri territory. You know, we also heard from Barbara in Prairie Village, who wasn't able to stay on the line, but she is sort of defending the mixer-uppers, the people who use it different ways at different times, because she says different members of her family have said different things. So to her, it's just sort of like, yeah, they're both right. Do you hear a lot of that? I guess this is a question for Matt.
Yeah, certainly, as we've discussed with politicians, but lots of people will vary their usage over time, yeah.
Okay, Matt Gordon, Chris Husted, hang on with me through the break. We'll pick back up with the politics of Missouri versus Missouri when Central Standard returns. You can call 816-235-2888 to join this discussion. 816-235-2888. Make your case. I'm Gina Kaufman. We will be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we are trying to determine how to pronounce the name of the state we are in right now. I say Missouri. Some of you might say Missouri, and neither of us is wrong necessarily. There's a whole history to the distinction, which we've been hearing about. We'll be pivoting to politics in how you say it in just a minute, but you can go ahead and call 816-235-2888 to chime in as a caller named Helen has done, and we'll be getting to her in just a moment. My guests are Christopher Husted of the public radio station in Columbia, KBIA, and Matt Gordon of the linguistics department at MU. Hi again, Chris.
Hello.
Hello again, Matt.
Hello.
Could you just quickly recap, Matt, what your research indicates about who says what and why?
Yeah. So the question of which form people actually use is a little complicated because of the issues of either wanting to identify a certain way or not wanting to identify a different way. But what I've found really interesting is the way that it's sort of used naturally in different spheres. So one of the convenient things about investigating this form is that you can look at it in written form, right? When people write Missouri and spell it with an A at the end, it's sort of a clear indication that they're trying to signal that pronunciation. And so I've been doing some research looking at what people do when they write it in tweets and in other sort of public areas.
What have you found?
Well, it's a lot of the points that we've sort of mentioned, that it clearly is meant to indicate a certain kind of social identity. So it's one of the things that I find most interesting is where people try to divide the state into two parts, the Missouri part and the Missouri part.
As though they are different geographical places.
Exactly. And there's certainly a dimension where they're sort of seeing them as different places in the mind as well, and all of that identity stuff that we've been mentioning. So
Would you be willing to hazard a guess about what goes with the identity of Missouri and what is part of what is being signaled about Missouri?
Yeah. Well, the Missouri is what we would call the marked form, right? It's the more unusual one, the one that is more of a conscious choice in that way. And what we find when people are using that form, it's often meant to make a comment about a certain kind of lifestyle. So it's about rural life as opposed to urban life or suburban life. It's about political values of a certain type, conservative values, Republican identity, that sort of thing. But also you see a lot of tweets that are about guns or just sometimes just some weird stuff. There's a phenomenon online that I'm sure many listeners are familiar with, the Florida man. It's a kind of meme, right? The sort of strange stories about someone who does something that seems kind of crazy to us, and it's about it's always a man in Florida. Well, there's lots of tweets that are you might call Missouri man tweets, where there's a crime. Just to give you one example, there was a crime story where a criminal was evading police and was hiding in some bushes, and then he was found out because of his flatulence. And the comment from the tweet about this story was simply, well, that's Missouri.
Okay, so it's being used to describe not even a place, but a kind of behavior.
Yeah, that's a great way of saying it.
All right. Chris, anything to add to that? I've got a call I want to go to, but I just as we reestablish kind of what is Missouri, what is Missouri?
Yeah, I would just add that, yes, you see Missouri, being used sometimes in a pejorative way to describe a certain type of person who's doing something. But on the flip side, you also see people using Missouri to signal that they're like they're from the area, they're in the know, they're one of us, they're
it's
real
kind of
Missourians.
Folksiness.
Yes, exactly.
All right, let's hear from Helen, who has called 816-235-2888 with her Missouri story. Helen, good morning.
Good morning, and I'm calling from Kansas City, Missouri, which is how I typically say it.
What do you want to share?
Yeah, so I feel like for me, there's a generational gap that my grandma was the one. She's from Nevada, Missouri, went to the University of Missouri, so that was her constant thing. And then I think that I also, when I switch back and forth, it has a lot to do with kind of the local versus national scope of what I'm talking about. So, like, I went to school out of state and would always say Missouri because anytime I would say Missouri, people were very confused. And so it just kind of stops the conversation, which I think has some political ramifications of, like, how much are you, you know, Missouri proud, which is only, you only hear that here, versus how much do you want to kind of blend in and say it like everybody else in your conversations outside of Missouri.
So who you are talking to, much like the politicians we heard about. Chris, pick back up with the political implications of all of this.
Yeah, so, you know, we talk about what Helen was talking about is code switching. We're talking about using certain pronunciations or language choices to speak to either a different group or a different person. Politicians do this all the time. And again, not Democratic or Republican specific, they both do it. And they'll switch depending on who they're with because they want to connect with their voters. They want to let the voters know that they're one of you. I'm one of you. I'm authentic.
Even if everyone knows they're not one of us.
Absolutely. I mean, at this point, in this day and era, we know where you're from and we know where you stand politically. And especially in the divisive political climate we have today, we know if you're going to be able to, if you're pandering to a voter or not.
Does it seem in some ways like, did you do your homework? Because I feel like when people come to Kansas City, knowing whether you're in Kansas or Missouri is kind of a big deal. And I wonder if it's a similar kind of thing once you get deeper into the state of Missouri or Missouri specifically.
Right. In a way, yes. Kit Bond had shared a story about when Mitt Romney came to Missouri in 2012. And he was really worked up about should he say Missouri or should he say Missouri. He chose Missouri. And as the former Senator Bond said, Mitt Romney kind of just flailed around and the voters just read right through it and said, you're not one of us. You can't say that. So you can flounder and be a little unsuccessful in trying to code switch when you're talking to voters, especially if you're not from the state.
Let's dig into that with someone who works on this question of whether a politician should say Missouri or Missouri. Annie Presley is a retired political strategist. She's done major fundraising for national political candidates in Kansas City. And Annie, you have some stories about this exact type of, I guess I'll say, freaking out about how to say Missouri or Missouri.
The candidates who came to Missouri, which is how I say it, always asked if they had any wherewithal about the situation or the question. And I always advised them that using Missouri and not being a resident was inauthentic and that they should just go with Missouri, the proper spelling, and not suffer what Romney suffered. And he did that every time he was here.
So he kept doing it even though it was backfiring?
It just doesn't sound normal. It doesn't sound authentic. It sounds like you're trying too hard. So it's what we would call a carpetbagger, somebody who comes in and tries to act like they belong when, in fact, they can't even pronounce it properly and they're so balled up about it that they can't spit it out one way or the other properly.
So have people typically heeded your warnings on that?
Oh, absolutely. If you say with authority, yes, just go with the more proper spelling and pronunciation, then they would typically do that. Romney was a tough guy.
When we were listening to George H.W. Bush pronouncing Missouri and pronouncing it that way in 1988, you were nodding in some recognition of that. In that speech, I didn't include this part, but he then goes on to assert that Missouri, pronounced again that way very confidently, is among the states he considers home states.
So he had a brother in St. Louis and family, and they spent time in Missouri. And St. Louis, as Matt and Chris have suggested, is more toward the Missouri pronunciation. So that would be how he naturally said it. Now, when George W. came, he tended toward the more casual pronunciation and oftentimes said Missouri. He also had a lot of Missouri people on his campaign for president. And the
specifically Missouri people.
Correct. So when you travel to Missouri, he'd be with Missouri people. And if that's how they said it, then you just kind of pick it up. So there are a lot of different reasons why people say it differently.
You have worked primarily for Republicans, right?
Yes, although not exclusively.
Do you find that the kinds of concerns people have when they're trying to decide how to pronounce it are the same across party lines?
Actually, the color of the tie is a far bigger question upon arrival than is the pronunciation of the state.
And tell me more.
Well, there's always the big decision about what to wear and if it's casual and it's business casual and what everybody else will have on. And the clothing department is far more important than this pronunciation question.
And the color of the tie is like the lightning rod here?
Well, it can be. And, you know, most Why? Of my candidates were guys, so they always were seeking female input on clothing.
But why? I'm so sorry to not know about this tie issue, but I'm not like into men's clothing in that way. So I guess I just don't know. What does it mean?
Well, when people are traveling and on the road a lot and they have different ties and they have a favorite and they have a favorite color. And if you're going into a really serious moment, you might want to wear a serious tie. If you're going into a lighthearted event, you might want to wear a less serious tie. Colors matter, blue, red, Republican, Democrat, all that kind of stuff plays in.
Chris Husted, when you hear all of this as a reporter, what does it mean to you?
I've seen that argument go down also, but oftentimes I used to cover agriculture a lot, so it was, should I wear jeans or should I wear my suit?
For you?
Yeah.
As you were traveling from place to place, did you also have that question about saying Missouri versus Missouri and as you covered agriculture?
As a reporter in my work, I've always said Missouri, but I let whoever speak how they want to. That being said, when I'm conducting the interview, I often will mimic who I am speaking with more so they feel comfortable and they can trust me, because they can. I'm not trying to do any gotcha reporting here, but I want them to feel comfortable. So by mimicking their tone and not necessarily their accent, but their cadence and their pacing and their body language, I'm trying to let them know that I'm trustworthy and you should be comfortable around me to share your story. Because oftentimes, especially in rural communities and the farmers I interview, they're not really interested in talking to a reporter. They're very private people. So I have to do my job, and that is using, I say Missouri so they don't think I'm a poser, but trying to make accommodate their behavior in my own.
Let's talk to Nancy in Kansas City. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I would like to say that my reason for saying Missouri came to my realization of why I did it today. I came to Kansas City going to Park College from Flint, Michigan, and soon after I came, I was approached by someone, I don't remember who told me, if you want to sound like part of the local region and maybe be a little more believable, it's probably smart to say Missouri and not Missouri like you're saying. And so I said, but it's spelled with an I. And they said, well, that doesn't matter. You need to say Missouri. And from that day on, which was decades ago, I came here in 1960s, I've been saying Missouri. But I will tell you, from this day on, I will say Missouri, because that's how it's spelled. And I realize that I've been saying it. Every time I say it, there's just a tinge somewhere in me that says, that's not right.
And it's not right.
And I teach English as a second language at the library. And I'm always careful about words and where they come from and what it means. And I've always felt like I was just slightly betraying myself by saying Missouri. So to me, it's being true to the spelling. And I realized I had changed to Missouri because I was caring about what other people thought and I wanted to be part of a gang and all
yes.
that.
Yes.
So,
Nancy,
so
it's the plight of college students everywhere, I should say. But also, Annie Presley, some politicians could stand to heed her advice and do what comes naturally.
Do what comes naturally. And I have to say, I cut my teeth on politics in the University of Missouri Tiger football parking lot. A lot of campaigning going on back in the day. And there's a great cheer, Missouri, 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 mm-hmm. Missouri Tigers. And people say Missouri a lot as a result of that fabulous cheer. And it sticks. After you've said it a few times, it just kind of sticks. So it has some political backing as well.
Let's hear from Ben in Overland Park. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Good. How about you?
Oh, I'm good. Just relaxing right now before I go on to work my job.
And you say Missouri or Missouri?
I say Missouri. My family actually came here to the state. It was back before it was state in the late 1700s. So, you know, I don't have an issue with anybody saying Missouri, but as my hairstylist kind of jokingly says, is it Mississippi or Mississippi? And I'm like, exactly.
Well, and there we are, back to Mississippi and Mississippi. Chris Husted, Matt Gordon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Annie Presley, thank you.
Thanks, Gina.
Annie Presley is a retired political strategist. Chris joined us from KBIA in Columbia, and Matt is a professor of English at MU. He also runs the linguistic department there. I'm Gina Kaufman. When we get back, we'll hear some tough stories about how some of the news we reported in 2019 is still affecting people in 2020. Looking back on 2019, one of the stories that came up a lot was the threat of raids by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, in cities throughout the U.S. We talked on this show about how anxiety over possible raids was affecting immigrants in Kansas City, regardless of their immigration status. We heard about what people were doing to prepare for the possibility of deportation. We heard about efforts to teach folks their rights. But what happens when someone does get deported? That part of the story may be harder to tell, but my colleague, Laura Ziegler, recently did just that. She spoke with Florencio Milan, who was dragged out of his car by ICE officials here in town in July. He was swiftly deported to Mexico.
Hello. Hi, is this Florencio?
Yeah, this is Sam.
It's Laura. How are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Florencio told Laura over the phone that he was having trouble finding a job in Mexico. A lot of people there find work in construction or farming. He doesn't know anything about that kind of work. He'd been a chef in Kansas City. Florencio was also missing his family.
It's difficult. There's no words to describe the feeling every night where I had to lay in bed by myself to wonder if they're doing okay.
Things have also been hard for his partner, Cheyenne Hoyt, who still lives here, and that includes the video chats that make it possible for Florencio to say goodnight to the kids.
It's just not the same. To me, I feel like it's a little bit harder because he gets upset because he can't do anything from over there.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We are talking about life after deportation on KCUR's Central Standard. My first guest for this discussion is Jessica Piedra. She's an immigration lawyer and community advocate. Hi, Jessica.
Hello, good morning.
Let's just establish some context before we hear stories again. Are there any major shifts you have noticed when it comes to raids and instances of deportation in the past year?
I mean, we saw the dramatic raid in Mississippi, obviously, with several plants, and we thought that was coming here. It still may. In our area, we're seeing more kind of quiet, well, not so quiet with Florencio's case, but one by one, folks getting picked up for things that they just living their lives that normally would not have resulted in being put into deportation proceedings.
So despite all the fears around raids, it is really the individual in instances that are still taking place more?
In our area at this time, we very well may see a large meatpacking is usually the industry, and we do have several of those in kind of rural areas in our Kansas-Missouri region.
There was a lot of attention on ICE raids, both potential and real, in 2019. What does that all look like in the rearview mirror to you?
I mean, just really terrible. We saw 600 people, you know, arrested in one swoop in Mississippi, and that just devastated their community. It ripples out. It's not just the parents, but, you know, that resulted in hundreds of U.S. citizen children being without guardians for several days. And the community, I think, the school was having to provide shelter and food. And that's going to have a huge impact even on their economy for much to come.
Why do people turn to you? What types of circumstances are they in? What kinds of advice are they seeking?
Well, we represent mostly Latino immigrants that have been here 10, 15, 20 years in our Kansas City area. most times they're looking to for help navigating affirmative applications where they're filing themselves, coming forward to the government because they have a U.S. citizen spouse or their U.S. citizen child is now 21. Those processes are very long and difficult and expensive. We also see folks that now a lot of those people who are already in that path are being picked up by ICE, where before, if they came into encounter with the government, they'd be like, well, just hurry up and do your papers. Now they're being placed into court proceedings and having to pay a $5,000 bond to get out of jail and have to deal with that deportation process in addition to what we're already doing.
How have shifts in policy and just approach to immigration law overall, what you're seeing, how has all of that affected the way you counsel clients as they pursue legal status in particular?
Yeah, it makes it difficult as an attorney. There's been not a lot of certainty in immigration ever, really, but now it's really difficult to say that what's going to happen. I mean, I can tell them possible scenarios of what we think is happening, but there's just been so many rapid changes over the last several years that it's hard to even keep up or imagine what's coming next.
When we talk about life after deportation, that is deeply personal for you.
It is.
Tell me your story.
Yeah, well, sometimes we say it was deportation. It was not. It was these affirmative path that I help my clients through to get a green card. Immigrants that have come here without a visa can't get their green card inside the United States. So in our case, my husband had done that, had come here for work without a visa, and had a U.S. citizen wife and two U.S. citizen children. The legal channel required him to return to Mexico to finish the process. But that was a scary thing, not knowing if he was going to be able to come back. And it required a long separation. He was there for an entire year when our littlest was only 3 years old.
What did that life after not deportation, but separation, how did that affect you?
Yeah, I was in the middle of my law school, so that was tough to work and care for two children and juggle my classes. Also, Cheyenne, you know, really it touched my heart remembering those days that our baby was only 3 years old and she didn't understand what was happening and she cried herself to sleep every night. Really, she was so attached to her father and she didn't understand why he couldn't be there to tuck her in at night.
I want to bring in our other guest now. Steve Stiegel has also experienced deportation and its aftermath. Actually, he is experiencing those things right now. He just got back from Mexico visiting his wife. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
How was your visit?
It's great. It's awesome when you get there, but it's horrible when you leave. So it's, you know, every time you get there, it's amazing. You hug her. But coming down to the end, it's like... you know, the last couple of days, you know you're leaving.
Tell me the story of how you met your wife.
I met her. I own a bar down in the River Market called the Blue Line. And she was working across the street at another restaurant. So while I was opening up my bar, I would go over there and eat lunch. And we just got to meet each other through that avenue.
You know, a lot of people, I think, assume that once you've married a U.S. citizen, that's all taken care of itself. It sounds like that just is not the case.
No, that is not the case, but you are right. A lot of people, whenever I tell them what happened, well, weren't you guys married? That's the first thing that comes out of their mouth. But like Jessica was saying, you know, there's a process, and they have to go back through Mexico to finish the process, and that can take, you know, up to 3 years at least.
Tell me the story of what ultimately led to her deportation.
Well, she got a DWI back in 2012. And that is what triggered, you know, the whole situation. But we went through the U.S. courts to try to show hardship that, hey, we need her here. She runs our business, you know, and this business is very successful. And she has a daughter, you know, that's going to school and that she needs her mom. And none of those things are good.
When you say none of those things are good, can you explain in a little more detail?
Well, at that point, it was if you didn't have a severe medical issue, like a child or me, like where we needed her, we absolutely needed her. It was life-threatening. If we didn't have her, we might die. That was the only way to keep her here.
there are kids in this equation, older kids, but kids.
Yes.
Tell me about them.
Well, our daughter, she is 18. She's going to KU. She graduated high school last year. So we had to live, we did a live feed. And Jennifer, actually, Jennifer's our daughter's name. She put her phone and had her mom on her speakerphone as she got up and took her graduation papers. So, you know, that's what we have to do. It's a different kind of life when she's on the other side of the border. You got to do things through technology and through the phone because she can't be there and it kills her mom.
What else has changed for you here?
Well, I mean, it's everyday life, you know, everyday life, taking care of the house, you know, going to work. And then, you know, sometimes Letty's, you know, she's depressed. She wants to be home with her family. And it's tough because you can't be there to hug her and tell her it's going to be okay. You got to do everything over the phone. So it's your life is totally changed.
And I do understand that that Letty still runs your bar.
Yes, she does. She is a beast when it comes to that. She runs it over. We have about 18 cameras at the bar, and she runs it from Mexico. And she hires, she fires, she talks to all the vendors.
She has a bar cam.
She has a bar cam. And she watches it daily, nightly. I mean, that's what she does. And if she sees something isn't going on right, she makes a phone call and she gets stuff done.
What do you see as your next steps?
Well, our next steps is just it's a waiting game. We're waiting for an interview at the embassy. We're hoping to get in there by April. And by the end of the year, we are praying that she is back by Christmas.
Are you angry? Are you hopeful? Where are you at emotionally with all of this?
You know, I'm everything. I am hopeful, but it's just like, it's hard to have hope whenever, you know, everything gets pushed back. We were hoping to have her back by the halfway through the year, but that isn't going to happen. We were hoping to have her in the embassy by the end of last year. That didn't happen. It's just like this administration finds ways to delay the process and push it back. And so it's very frustrating.
Are delays a part of what you see, Jessica, in your legal practice?
Definitely, especially in the step that the Stigall family is in right now. We've seen it used to take 2 to 4 months to get this interview at the embassy in Mexico, is where most of my clients are as well. And now it is taking 8, 9 months, a year to get those interviews scheduled. And when your family member, a lot of my clients, their family members are here waiting to leave and then come back. But when your family member is, and that's hard enough, but when your family member is separated from the family, that every day is painful.
What's your sense of why it is taking longer?
There's been a lot of changes. Everything is taking longer in immigration in the last 2 years. At the same time, there's a huge threat of doubling filing fees while the service has slowed down. So we're really hoping that doesn't happen.
Can you explain that?
The Trump administration announced in late 2019 a proposal to double a lot of the or radically increase most of the filing fees, including the citizenship fee and adding an asylum fee for the first time. And the comment period ended in December, so there's no set date for that to start, but we're hoping that it is further delayed because it will price more people even out of the legal system.
What recourse do people have once someone in their life has been deported? Are there options?
I mean, very few. We were chatting, you know, it's hard to get, you know, we've got some friendly congressmen here, but what they say, like you've said, is that there's really nothing unusual about the delay that the Stigall family is facing and a lot of my clients are facing. Really, we need a radical overhaul of the immigration system to put it in line and keep American families together.
I mean, what tends to happen next?
I mean, people just wait.
And Steve is nodding.
Yes, that is very true. And I just want to say one thing real quick.
Yeah,
Letty,
please.
I know you're listening. I love you, honey. Keep your head up, and we will get you back home.
Our time is up. Steve Stigall, best of luck coping with your family situation. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, too.
Jessica Piedra, immigration lawyer and community advocate, thank you.
Thank you.
That is it for today. Both of our conversations will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. We have Missouri versus Missouri and life after deportation. kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can talk to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. Tomorrow, there are rules about haircuts in the U.S. military, and a local researcher has a few thoughts to share on how that interacts with people's identities. Tomorrow at 10, we'll have that conversation. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.